If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through... You deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame...
Two more, Rex.
You deserve this ice-cold reward. Modelo, the markable fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague, Peter Flaherty. Millie is running around. She's kind of hyper. She, I think, knows that I'm getting ready to leave because it is Omaha week and I'm getting ready to go to the College World Series. We are all very excited that the College World Series begins on Friday. And as you listen to this, that'll probably be tomorrow. But, you know, whenever you're catching this, World Series starts on Friday. We've got a full field after it was an interesting round of Super Regionals. I guess, Peter, let's start there. What did you think of the round overall? Because the Super Regionals for me started really slowly. There were, like, the hosts won six of them, and there were only two game threes. So, like, on the one hand, it felt a little like, you know, it wasn't the best round. On the other hand, there were some absolutely thrilling games in there. So it's kind of hard for me to evaluate, like, was that a good weekend of Super Regionals or not? So I guess let's start there. Like, what did you think of the round overall?
Yeah, I mean, the results themselves were pretty chalky, I would say. But there were some unbelievable games sprinkled in there, obviously. The second game of the Florida-Clemson Super Regional, we had a couple of really good games with North Carolina and West Virginia. The third game of Georgia and NC State was solid. Evansville gave Tennessee all it could handle. So, I mean, there were some good games sprinkled in there. But overall, I don't want to say underwhelming, but it was not a weekend if you're a fan of upsets. It was not the weekend for you.
Yeah, this is not the tournament for upsets. I mean, I guess that was okay in the first round. You did have a number four seed advancing. But they washed all of the potential underdogs or Cinderellas. Those are all gone now. And we are left with a field of four ACC teams, four SEC teams. Seven of them were regional hosts. The one that isn't is Florida. And obviously Florida was... You know, a bubble team to get into the tournament, but it also was a top five team in the preseason, and nobody is confused about Florida's talent level or anything. So if you're looking for underdog stories, you have to look a little bit harder. They're there. We can get to them. But I guess the other very notable thing about this field now that we have it for Omaha, Peter, is that there are four ACC teams and four SEC teams. Not since the College World Series expanded beyond just having two teams play a best of three series, have just two conferences been represented in the field. So this is a first for Omaha back when it was just a three-game series. They played that in Kalamazoo, Michigan, of all places. Just two conferences. I guess there's a lot that we can talk about in terms of that. I don't really want to get into all of it. I have not really had time to, like, fully process my own full thoughts. So I'm not going to ask you to, like, is this good for college baseball? Or, you know, we don't have to go into the big, big questions. But as you look at it, does this seem right for this season? You know, like, from the jump, really, if you look at our preseason rankings, it was really heavy on SEC and ACC teams. You know, we had Oregon State and TCU in the preseason. And, you know, but throughout the season, really, these two conferences dominated the top 10 of the top 25.
Not to pat ourselves on the back here, but just going off our preseason rankings, like, so much of the comments and the feedback were, look at how loaded the Carolinas are and look at how loaded, you know, that geographical region of the country is. And when all is said and done, you have two teams from the triangle in North Carolina and NC State. And then in just the Southeast region as a whole, depending on how you define it, 7 of the 8 teams are from that area. So, I mean, I think it is like a little bit of a nice full circle moment to the season. I didn't foresee even going into the super regional weekend where it was a possibility to be all ACC against all SEC. I didn't think it was going to pan out that way. But it did. And I think it adds a fun little wrinkle to it because it's always kind of a hot button issue and debate, like the ACC versus the SEC, who's more talented. And this won't solve it. It'll only add to the debate in future years. But I think it is a very interesting little wrinkle to it all.
I'll be completely honest here. I did not for one second stop to think when we saw the super regional field, like that this was a possibility. I didn't know that this was a possibility. I mean, I guess like if I'd really like thought about it, it would have been like, oh, all the hosts are SEC and ACC hosts. Hosts often win super regionals. But I didn't stop and consider that this was a possibility until our editor, JJ Cooper, tweeted something. I think it was on Saturday. At that point, you know, the Friday Supers had started the way they had with all, you know, 3-8 ACC teams going and winning game one and Tennessee winning game one. So that was a strong start to the possibility. But I just went into the weekend so sure that, you know, Oregon State or West Virginia, specifically those two, like one of them was going to win, or, you know, K-State or UConn was going to do something, or maybe Oregon, that I didn't consider this at all. And maybe that's on me, but like the chalkiness of the super regional round, how much the hosts dominated it, was, I mean, it wasn't like disheartening to me, but it was kind of boring a lot of the weekend, because even the really great super regionals, like, you know, Clemson losing to Florida, and like that is an outlier. It was a sweep. It was two great games. The road team won, and, you know, sure, NC State went on the road to Georgia and won, but that was what, if you listen last week, I was hemming and hawing the whole time trying to make a pick in that. So, you know, that wasn't terribly surprising, but like almost everywhere else, it was just like the hosts were clearly in control, even when it was hard for them. Like Tennessee goes down, you know, to Evansville, and they lose a game, you know, game three is forced, and you're like, well, but is Tennessee really going to lose this thing? And of course, it was game three was a blowout, and, you know, other hosts got pushed, and we'll get into all of this. But it was always just like, too often for me, for my taste, it was just like, well, the hosts, they're in control here. Like, yeah, it's a tight game now, but are they really going to lose this? And so that was the one like kind of disappointing thing for me from the weekend. I guess umpiring was a second one. We'll get into that later. But an interesting round. What it does, though, like we had a fun regional round. We talked about that. There were 10 walk-offs and all the rest of that. Like that was really cool. Super regionals, not so cool this year, maybe, or at least not as exciting and thrilling as the regionals were. But it does set up this incredible Omaha field where you have, you know, 8 super talented teams, 8 teams. There, I believe, Peter, is no weak link here. All 8 teams can go to Omaha believing that they realistically can win the national championship.
Yeah, even last year in Omaha, it was LSU and Wake got matched up in the same bracket, so obviously everyone knew one of them had to go down, but there is no clear-cut, I'd say, favorite this year. As you alluded to, there's a very valid argument for any of these 8 teams as to why they will win the national championship, so I think it's going to make for a really entertaining week and a half or so.
We can start with number 1 Tennessee. They played Evansville. The Volunteers were at home, of course, as the number 1 overall seed. And Evansville, the lone number 4 team to have advanced, they did not get the message that, you know, their Cinderella run was supposed to be over. They played really hard in game 1. As I said, they went out, they won game 2 in comeback fashion after Tennessee had, you know, punched them in the mouth pretty good in the first inning. Evansville bounces back, and goes on and wins game two. Tennessee comes back, wins game three. Really no sweat. Xander Seacrest pitched very well. And there are a number of different ways we can look at this, Peter, from a Tennessee perspective. But I guess let's start with the Evansville perspective and just say, job really well done. That was an incredibly tough assignment, but they made it for a really, they pushed Tennessee as much as they could have been asked to, really. And unfortunately, they just ran out of gas in game three. But otherwise, a really fun weekend in Knoxville and Evansville. Pushing Tennessee that hard was not something I saw coming.
Yeah, I give all the credit in the world to them, and there's so much for them to be proud of this season. They won the regional. They won their conference tournament championship for the first time since 2006. They gave Tennessee all it could handle, and they were one win away from the College World Series. Like, that was really, really impressive what they did, not just this past weekend, but for the past, 2 weeks or so, dating back to the conference tournament. And they're a really gritty, fun team to watch. They play the game incredibly hard. Ty Rumsey especially made a handful, even going back to the regionals, he made a handful of big-time plays in the outfield. That lineup just battles and battles with Schallenberger and Fugarus and Simon Sherry, Chase Hug, like, up and down, they gave Tennessee really, really tough and competitive at-bats all weekend, and I was blown away. And I think for me, like, taking the takeaway from that weekend, like, I'm not alarmed with the way in which Tennessee made it to Omaha. Like, I don't think it's a red flag at all. Maybe not at all, but I was more just impressed with Evansville. Like, I think, I think that Tennessee is still set up pretty well for a deep run here in Omaha. And my overall thoughts on them didn't really change at all from one weekend.
I'm not concerned that, Tennessee lost a game, got pushed kind of hard by this team that nobody was expecting to do much of anything in Evansville. Tennessee became the first number one overall seed to lose to a regional four seed in the NCAA tournament in the 64 team era. Like I said last week, I kind of thought Evansville got underseeded. I kind of thought they and VCU should have been flipped as the 3-4 in Greenville, but whatever. My concern about Tennessee from this weekend is that for the last few weeks, Drew Beam, who is supposed to be like the most stable of the pitchers on the Tennessee staff, he has, this is his third year as a starter in the SEC. He just hasn't really looked himself. He hasn't made it through, I believe it's through four or through five innings in the last 3 weeks, in the postseason. And, obviously Tennessee likes its bullpen. It has its plan. Like, it's happy to just move on from its starter. But I do think, this Tennessee bullpen is not as deep as it was in, say, 2022. And if Drew Beam is suddenly not going to be the rock in the middle of the rotation, I do wonder. And, they lost his start. Like, that was his start that they lost. And they lost it in the SEC tournament, I believe, as well. Or no, that wasn't his start. But they've just had to work harder in his starts, and those are supposed to be the starts that are the easier ones. Now, the flip side of that is Xander Seacrest has pitched really well of late. And, so maybe in finding something in Seacrest, that kind of makes up for whatever they're losing in Beam right now. But it's not the time you want to see the guy that, has been this 3-year-long presence in your rotation, have him be scuffling a little bit and be anything less than, the rock solid piece you have come to expect him to be.
Yeah, the one thing with Tennessee is, and I'm glad that we're bringing it up now, is they have as much depth on both sides of the baseball as anyone. Like, the lineup is the lineup at this point. We don't need to, anyone listening to this is not unfamiliar with Christian Moore, Blake Burke, Billy Amick's game, and a whole host of others. But on the mound right now, I guess outside of Xander Seacrest to an extent, there's not a guy that they can really point to or maybe be ultra confident in, like, okay, he's going to give us 6 to 7 shutdown innings where it's like 1 to 2 earned runs, and holding an offense in check. And they're going to have, you know, there are going to be tough offenses that they'll have to face. And I love the depth overall. Like, you look up and down, you have Nate Snead, who can go for an extended period of time. AJ Causey has been masterful in this swing role they have him in. Xander Seacrest, you've spoken about already. And Drew Beam, when he's on, is really damn good. But, like, that's just the one thing I wonder if it's going to do him in is, like, another bad start or two, like, if the offense can pick him up. Because the one thing offensively, I'm not worried about the Tennessee offense, but Charles Schwab Stadium is notorious for being a very pitcher-friendly park. And Tennessee is, I don't want to say home run reliant, but, like, can they win without hitting 3 to 4+ home runs in a game? Like, is this an environment that's more conducive to, like, an NC State where it's like a bunch of, you know, outside of Makarevich and Pennington, like, they've got 9 guys who just kind of pepper the field with line drive. Like, I'm just very curious to see how it all translates for Tennessee. They're my national championship pick, but it doesn't come without questions.
It's interesting. You know, Causey is great in his role, but he's not, you know, they have an opener for a reason, I guess. And, you know, you saw it on Friday in the Super that, and you've seen it happen a couple times, that Tennessee maybe gets just a little bit greedy with the opener and, you know, they don't go to Causey quite on schedule or quite fast enough. And then they give up a few runs and then all of a sudden you have to work a little bit harder. And, you know, it's fine in the home ballpark. It's fine in most ballparks. And, you know, we certainly know that you can hit home runs in Charles Schwab Field now, but it is different. And it's a less forgiving ballpark than what Tennessee is used to playing in. So there, I mean, that can help your pitching, of course, but it does raise some questions. And, you know, you look at Tennessee, they lead the nation in home runs. You know, there can be some questions about how that's going to translate, but you know, if you hit home runs at the rate that they're hitting them, like, it's going to be all right. It's not just a short porch creation, but, you know, Billy Amick, he can hit some, you know, and Christian Moore, he can hit some. And so they're going to find a way, but it is a little bit less certain than you would expect, maybe the number one overall team to be, but that's just kind of been the season of college baseball. So, we shall see with Tennessee. Moving down the down that bracket one, we'll go to Tennessee's opponent on Friday night, and that is Florida State. Florida State swept UConn over the weekend. This one feels like it was over forever ago because it was the first super regional to start and finish with the noon kickoff on Friday and an 11 a.m. start on Saturday. Florida State hammered UConn in game one. They set a super regional scoring record, a super regional run difference record. UConn came back and gave them extra innings in a really thrilling game two on Saturday. Ultimately, though, Florida State was too much. They win it in extra innings, and now Florida State is headed back to Omaha for the first time since 2019 and the first time under second-year coach Link Jarrett.
Pretty remarkable turnaround in Tallahassee in year two for Coach Jarrett and company. Like, last year was not, like, that is going to be, I think, looking back in however long, that is going to be a severe anomaly as to the track record he establishes at Florida State. But pretty convincing overall, I thought, for the Seminoles. Like, I wasn't expecting UConn after that 24-4 demolition to just, like, roll over and not punch back a little bit. In the second game, which they did, and it took a Florida State, James Tibbs, his third home run of the game, to lift them to victory. But I was really close to picking a couple of other teams other than Tennessee to win the national title, and Florida State was one of them. They have college baseball's version of the Bash Brothers and Cam Smith and James Tibbs in that lineup. But I think having that, and those are two exceptional players, that maybe overshadows a guy that I talked about in Teddy and I's Omaha crystal ball piece that's up on baseballamerica.com right now. Max Williams is really, really solid for them. And so has Marco Dinges, Jaime Ferrer, Daniel Cantu, even Alex Lodis. He's hitting better and is a lot better of a player than his slash line suggests. Like, it is a really, really deep lineup. And where you have a Tennessee team right now that I don't want to say they're struggling on the mound, but like we've said, they don't really have maybe a shutdown guy, and where it's likely going to be probably Jamie Arnold in that first game. Like, it's a really tough opening game for the Vols. And if Florida State can go out and start off 1-0, that's going to put them in a really, really good position, I think. And even outside of Arnold, like, Brennan Oxford has been really good in relief. John Abraham better as of late. They have these pieces, and getting Connor Whitaker back is so huge. They're going to be a really, really dangerous team. And I think that'll be kind of the common theme here in the podcast, is like all eight of these teams that we're going to talk about, like, they, like, there is a legit reason as to why they could win the national title. And FSU does have the pieces to do that.
Yeah, the concern for Florida State is the same that we've been talking about for like more than half the season now. Like, what is their pitching? Do they have enough pitching without Cam Leiter, who is now done for the season? And that's just a thing you have to watch. Jamie Arnold was not at his best against UConn. He'll be ready to go on Friday against Tennessee. He's he just is the best pitcher in the field, at least from a prospect standpoint. And, you know, that Tennessee lineup is going to have its hands full against him. But if they don't win that game, things get a lot more complicated for Florida State trying to break out of a loser's bracket, because we just haven't seen that much depth on the mound from them. They seem like they have 4 to 5 guys right now. Maybe that's selling it a little bit short that they want to keep it to, though. And once you get dropped into a loser's bracket, you need more. Now, the thing about that is probably a lot of people would have said the same thing about LSU this time last year. And what we learned in Omaha was that LSU had this incredible depth of pitching that just hadn't pitched as well as it could have during the regular season. And it all showed up in Omaha in a big way. And so maybe somebody, whether that's Florida State or somebody else in this field, can put that together. But it just seems like, and this is going to be another common theme, that a lot of these teams seem like they're a little short on the mound. And that's just kind of college baseball this year. And so maybe that evens itself out. But I do think maybe more than ever this year that the staying on schedule, staying in the winner's bracket is going to be critical.
Whether it's in Omaha or a regional setting or even in a conference tournament, staying in the winner's bracket is so, so critical. And with FSU, like, someone on this pitching staff is going to have to step up outside of the usual suspects, whether it's someone like a Joe Charles or Andrew Armstrong. Like, someone is going to have to go out and give them quality innings, likely more than once. So it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds.
All right, the other game on Friday in Omaha is North Carolina playing Virginia, two opponents that are very familiar with each other. Let's start in Chapel Thrill, which was, again, very thrilling this weekend. UNC sweeps West Virginia, but both games were incredibly tight. On Friday, it sure looked like West Virginia was going to win against UNC with Derek Clark on the mound, but Derek Clark eventually ran out of gas, and at that point Aiden Major came in, and it was a little too late to stop the Heels momentum, and Vance Honeycutt hits a 2-run walk-off shot, and UNC wins that game. The Saturday game was a very low scoring affair, which was surprising to me a little bit, but West Virginia did a great job silencing the UNC offense, but it wasn't enough. They couldn't get enough offense of their own against Jason DeCaro and friends. And so UNC wins 2-1, and they are headed to Omaha for the first time since 2018 and the first time under Scott Forbes, who is in his fourth season now.
Yeah, we've long talked about UNC as kind of flying under the radar as one of the best teams in the country, and they've proven it on two consecutive weekends now with that incredibly hard-fought regional win over LSU and then an equally hard-fought super regional win over West Virginia. And they did do it in a sweep, but it did not feel like a sweep. Like, two really, really hard-fought games. Vance Honeycutt more than rose to the occasion. Other guys came through with some big-time hits. Luke Stevenson hit a game-tying home run. Parks Harbor had a couple of big swings. And then Jason DeCaro pitched like anything but an 18-year-old true freshman. So really impressive to watch. Their bullpen has been nails like it has been all year. The one question that I have about the Heels is that I think away from Bosch-Emmer Stadium this year, whether it's in true road games in which they're 9-8 or neutral site games, which they're, I think, 1-3, they're 10-11 away from home. And now I know that's a really kind of a small sample size, but it's not a nothing burger. So again, I like playing at Charles Schwab is such a, it's such a unique, incredible environment where like, I think you can throw out the road and neutral splits. Like it is a beast of its own. Like it's unlike anything in college baseball. So, but still I'm interested to see how they do there. But like, I think that again, especially because of maybe it's depth on the mound, and don't get me wrong, their lineup can really, really swing it. They're probably 7-8 deep of guys who can consistently put together quality at bats. But I'm very impressed with UNC's bullpen depth, whether it's Dalton Pence, Matthew Mathias, Kyle Percival, Connor, like there are weapons upon weapons in that bullpen who have gone out in these really big spots. They've thrown really well. They're not going to be afraid to take the ball in a big spot in Omaha. And they've more than risen to the occasion. So again, like as we'll say for all these teams, like they're really, really dangerous. And I think that first round matchup against Virginia is a tough one. If you remember back to earlier in the ACC slate, they lost 2 of 3 in Charlottesville in kind of convincing ish fashion. So I'm curious to see how they've progressed since then against UVA.
I'm going to quickly pour one out for West Virginia. Best season in program history, sends Randy Mazey off into retirement. I mean, they were so close in both of those games. It felt like they, you know, they really could have done it either time. Just they were not the better team on either day. And, you know, so kudos to West Virginia for this run. You know, going down to Chapel Hill just proved to be a little bit too much of a hill, I guess, to climb. And there's no shame in that. That program remains on the ascension. UNC in Omaha, I don't know what to make of those home road splits. I think that the team is relatively built for Omaha. Just you look at that outfield defense and they are going to cover, you have to cover ground in Charles Schwab Field. It's a big outfield. Those guys are like Bosch-Emmer Stadium also has a pretty big outfield and they do a great job covering it. The lineup runs pretty deep. It's not home run dependent. They have this nice pitching staff with all of those bullpen options and the starting rotation is not like, that's not the strength, but that's okay. They do a really good job of managing the staff to get to the bullpen guys at the right time. This matchup though, I don't love it for them. You know, the fact that Virginia is going to come in with confidence, having already beaten them twice. And yeah, it's different to play Virginia and not in Charlottesville. And I don't know how much we can take from anything in April, but, and I keep, you know, saying like, I'll be right back on UNC if they win this weekend. And then I look at the match and I'm like, I don't know. And you know, then UNC just wins anyway. So maybe UNC doesn't want me back on the bandwagon, but that's okay. I'm not, it's fine. I think that they are perfectly capable of going out and winning, just like I've thought all year. This is a challenging bracket for them, and we'll see what they've got. But this is a team that certainly has earned its way here. They are probably as tested as any team in this tournament field, maybe with the exception of Florida, just because Florida's had to go on the road back-to-back weekends. But the games that UNC has had to win to get to this point, like they are very battle tested right now.
Yeah, one, they're battle tested, and not to get right into UVA, but I think it is a seamless transition. Like UVA right now is also like they are hitting its stride at the perfect time, especially on the mound. Like the pitching in the postseason has, to say it stepped up would be putting it extremely lightly. Through 5 games, I think they've allowed just 16 total runs as a staff. And Jay Woolfolk has come into his own in the rotation. Joseph Vino has been kind of the weapon that I thought he would be coming into this year. Like I thought that was a really nice get in the portal. And he's just now rounding into form at the perfect time. And Evan Blanco has been so steady all season, a soft tossing pitchability lefty, and they have their, it's a little bit like they're in the mold of NC State with how they have Jacob Duden and Derek Smith. Like, UVA is very comfortable going to in on multiple times in a weekend, and it'll be the case in Omaha. But like that trio of Chase Hungate, Funky Sidewinder, who's an innings eater, Angelo Tanas and Matt Augustine, like those are their guys, and they're going to ride them in Omaha just how they have for the last however many weeks. And it's kind of like, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like they withstood the regional weekend. They did the same thing during Supers. But I am curious, like if they get into kind of a, you know, where they got to play a higher amount of games than they did even on regional weekend, like who else can they turn to? But like Virginia is, they're also firing on all cylinders. They've beaten UNC before, and it's certainly a familiar matchup and one that they're not going to be afraid of. So I think it's going to be a great game.
Yeah, Virginia has swept through. They swept the regional, and then they swept the super against Kansas State. And there were some difficult games in there, like Mississippi State pushed them on regional weekend. And K-State was in those games until the later innings both times, I would say. So it's not like Virginia hasn't been tested. They've passed with very, very, very flying colors, I guess. That's probably not a great phrase, but they've done great in this round, these two rounds to this point. And I have been very impressed by just the way that they've embraced who their pitchers are at this stage. You know, Jay Wolfolk was a guy that, you know, started the year in the rotation, and, you know, they moved him all over the place trying to figure out where best to use him. And, you know, now here he is, and like he pitched game three of the regional and he had like the best game of his career. So what does Virginia do? They put him on the mound in game two. They move him up a day. You know, like I just appreciate that, like they are riding hot hands right now, that, you know, they've been working all season to try and get this pitching staff into the right spot, and having done so now, they absolutely have done so, and they're willing to, you know, keep shuffling, keep trying pieces, you know, just pushing everything, pushing all the buttons they need to push. And so I really like Virginia this week. I have them winning this bracket, actually, and that's riding maybe a little bit dangerously. They've been now to Omaha three times in the last four seasons. In 21, they went 1-2, and in 23, you know, last year, they go 0-2. So, you know, they've been really good at getting to this point and not so good at winning games lately. But I do think it can be different this year. I like the experience factor. I like how they're pitching, like that's a primary part of this. And then for me, it's the best lineup in the country. I know some people will point to Tennessee, but for me, Virginia is the best lineup in the country. And so if they're going to combine that with this kind of pitching, like I feel like they have a really good chance to make some noise this week.
Yeah, and that the one point that you hit on that I didn't was its lineup, and you're absolutely right that there is an argument to be made that it's the most prolific and deep one, not only in the field, but in the country. So they've got it all firing on all cylinders right now.
All right, we're going to get a break in here. We're going to move on to the second bracket, which starts play in Omaha on Saturday. Definitely a lot to get to with that. So we'll do that here in a second. But first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't help you just hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. What I love about Indeed is how much easier it has made the hiring process. Everything I need is all in one place. The ways to contact potential employees, job candidates, all in one place. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica. Just go to Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
All right, Peter, here on the in bracket two, we've got Kentucky, Texas A&M, we've got Florida and NC State. I guess we'll start with the first game that we're going to see on Saturday, and we'll start with Kentucky. Kentucky was the last team to get going in Super Regionals. They had a late date with Oregon State. Kentucky swept that series very convincingly. They allowed 3 hits over 2 games to Oregon State, and that is a lineup that absolutely can swing it. Trey Pusser was excellent on Saturday night to start things off. 7 scoreless innings, holding them to 1 hit, and then they just kept pitching all weekend long. And Kentucky is in Omaha for the first time in program history. The fantastic season in Lexington continues.
Yeah, it was really, really impressive how they beat Oregon State, especially in that second game where it was really, really tightly contested. And then I think it was in the 7th inning what the difference maker was, not only in that game, but also in the series. You have, I think it was Grant Smith who struck out they ruled it a wild pitch. I think it should have been a pass ball, but that's neither here nor there. And a slider that gets away from the catcher. Nolan McCarthy, who had been, he was the entire offense in that second game. But he's on second base. He takes third and he really doesn't slow down running at all and sees the pitcher kind of loafing towards home plate and busts it down towards home and slides in safely. They take the lead 3-2 and the bullpen handles the rest of it. So, at least some teams, it feels like they're sitting in the dugout after a weekend against Kentucky being like, how did we lose to this team? And that's not me insulting Kentucky at all. Like, they're a really, really good team. They are not in Omaha by accident. Like, they didn't fail upwards at all. Like, they're also a national championship contender, but it's like, they play such a gritty, different style of baseball than any of these other 8 teams and really any of the other teams that they've faced this year. And like Wofford, I guess, is the only similar team, but it's like they don't have the flashy names, I guess, other than Ryan Waldschmidt and maybe Emilian Petre to an extent that some of these other teams have. It's just like experienced guys. They know what it takes to win. They're very a low heartbeat type of team, and they play the game really hard, and it's clear that they love playing for each other as well. So, these are all ingredients that bode incredibly well for another successful week and a half for the Cats.
Yeah, both Peter and I came into that weekend very confident in Oregon State, and Kentucky just was like, oh, whatever. This team, okay, we'll just keep doing our thing. And here they are doing their thing in Omaha. Now it's just so impressive the way that they've been able to roll through this all. Pusser has been great at the front end, and you're right. They don't have Waldschmidt is, I guess at this point, probably a first rounder. And I don't know how many people that's been a developing story throughout the spring, but I don't know how many people are truly aware of what Ryan Waldschmidt is all about still. And outside of him, Burks and Petrie have been there a while and they're, solid prospects in their own right. But like, this is not, it's not like the household name kind of team, but it's a team that, you know, if you're looking for an underdog, this is one of your best shots, because this is a program that has no history of doing stuff like this before. You know, just a couple super regionals before this year, never been to this stage, not even in, you know, the 60s or the 70s or anything, just absolutely never been here. And I will be interested to see how they handle the stage, how, you know, because pretty much nobody has experience like this on the roster. Mitchell Daly, who transferred from Texas, does, and I think he's literally the only one. And, you know, but they haven't really cared about doing stuff that they haven't done before. You know, they never had a home super regional before, and, you know, that kind of pressure on them did not faze them one bit. So I'm curious to see how they handle Omaha, any first-time team in Omaha. Like, you're always a little curious how they are going to handle the stage, but this team is just so old and they're just so used to doing things that they haven't done before that it might not faze them one bit.
Yeah, they're so nails. Like, they kind of have that, like, the collective mentality of like Rocky and Rocky IV when he's walking out into the Ivan Drago fight in Soviet Russia, where it's all the Russians are yelling at him and he's just got this stone face. Like, that's what they're about. And, like, even though they haven't been here before, and like, I think that they are not going to be, like, blown away or deer in headlights. Like, I think that they're going to be ready and up for it. And so, again, like, they are going to really push the pace on teams. And you talk about a style of play that bodes well for Omaha. I think Kentucky's does really, really well. And I've already talked about it, but, like, they're not afraid to play small. They'll take an extra base, whether it be on, like, a pass ball wild pitch or a ball in a gap or down the line. Like, they're really, really going to push it. So it's a, like, them against NC State, I think, is a really fascinating opening matchup.
Yeah, so let's get to NC State, the team that won the Athens Super Regional. NC State goes into Georgia, beats the Bulldogs in three games. The first two games were traded. The two teams traded blowouts. State won the first one. Georgia won the second one. Game three was not a blowout, but NC State felt like they were in control a pretty healthy amount of time in that game. And they wind up winning the series, and they're back in Omaha for the first time since 2021. You might have heard about what happened to them on that trip. But this year, they're back, and, you know, this is a team that early in the season, you know, we were talking about, like, oh, like, they don't have any depth, and, like, what's up with NC State? And then they start winning some series, and I, like, you know, noted that, like, they couldn't win on Sunday and they couldn't win in the midweek. And then they resolved that lately. They have found a way to improve over the course of the season. And it's important to remember that teams are allowed to do that. What you see in March is not what that team is the whole season long. I think sometimes fans, like, forget that this is a, you know, this whole thing is a journey, and, you know, what you see in February and March and even April is not necessarily what you're going to see in May and into June. And I think NC State's a perfect example of that. They play a few freshmen in important spots. Those guys have grown into their roles. They've done a good job of developing some depth on the mound. It's still not, like, this is not the best pitching staff in the field, but they have their guys, and they're pitching pretty well at this point. You know, coming out of Athens is no easy task, but they were able to tame that really tough Georgia offense.
And with NC State, you know, they've got series wins, I think, over definitely UVA and UNC. So that's two of the eight. They had a series split, I guess, with Florida State down in Tallahassee. Like, they have a really, really impressive resume, even if their record maybe on paper doesn't necessarily scream, like, I don't know, it doesn't totally.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have 50 wins like some of the, or 45 wins. I don't even think they've won 40 games. Like, it's because they couldn't win on Sundays and Tuesdays for a while, but, like, they were still winning the series.
Exactly. And the quality of series victory, like, I'd put that up against any one of the Omaha eight. But similar with you and Virginia, like, I picked NC State as the runner-up and for them to come out of this bracket, and it's a really, really tough one, as it includes a darn good Kentucky team that we talked about, A&M and Florida, which we'll get to. But maybe I'm a prisoner of the moment here. I just really, really like how they're playing, not for the better half of 2 months, honestly, but especially last weekend. Like, I think we both ended up picking Georgia. I certainly expected Georgia to come out of that with a super regional win, and going down to Foley Field and holding that offense in check is no small feat. And like you said on the mound, it's a lot like Virginia. Like, they've got their guys, and this is not an insult to Sam Highfill, Logan Whitaker, or really anyone in that rotation. Like, it's pretty stocky, at least on the right-handed side with Highfill and Whitaker, but it's just experienced strike throwers. They throw quality strikes. They know how to stay off the barrel and have been doing so in big spots. And then you throw in that dynamic duo of Jacob Duden and Derek Smith, who, even though their respective stat lines are pretty solid, like, they're way better than what their stat lines are as well. And they've got some nice supplemental pieces with Dom Fritton, who can go out and give him a quality outing, Ryan Marone. There are a number of guys, and then the lineup is just relentless, and it's led by Makarevich and Garrett Pennington, both of whom are enjoying career seasons, and Jacob Cozart, Eli Serrano had a great super regional. And then even their guys in the second half of the lineup, like 5 through 9 or even 4 through 9, like, really since the ACC tournament and maybe even a little further back than that, it's just competitive at bat upon competitive at bat. They are so tough to get out, and they just wear pitching staffs down over the game. And it feels like everyone in that lineup right now is coming through with a big hit when they need to. And like, just watching them play, I don't really even know how to explain it. They just have that look of a team that is not done playing anytime soon. Like, I think that last weekend was just is going to propel them even more.
Yeah, it's just a team that knows who they are. I think at the end of the day, the pitching staff, the numbers are bad. Like, I don't even think I can like say they're mediocre. The numbers, if you look at the stat sheet, it just looks bad. But they figured it out. They know who they are at this point. They know who they need to go to, and it just took some time for them to get there, and that's fine. And you know, the lineup is, you know, Cozart is a, you know, first round pick, and you know, the rest of the guys maybe aren't at that kind of elite level, but like Makarevich is one of the, you know, he's going to be an All-American, and you know, they just have guys like that in this lineup. And to your point, Peter, like, yeah, they're certainly feeling it. You look at the way that they're playing right now, like, nothing really phases them. They took what they, you know, they're just any game they roll into, I think they're very confident in, and you can see it in the way that they approach it, both, you know, when they're hitting or when they're in the field. Like, they always seem to trust that something good is going to happen, that the guy that they've got out there is the right guy. And if he's not, the coaching staff is going to put in the right guy, you know, here in a second. And, you know, they've done a great job at making the right moves. And they are a team with some experience. You know, some of those guys were part of that 21 team, and some of those guys are just a little bit older. Like, they are not going to be fazed by what they see this weekend, I don't think. And it's going to be a very intriguing opening game against Kentucky, seeing some of that experience against some of the inexperience, but also just two teams that are very confident in who they are and what they do.
That's another great point. And with NC State, like, they're absolutely going to be playing on a massive chip on its shoulder, given what transpired in 21. You mentioned, like, there are some guys on that team who are there, some are not, but like, there is no doubt that they are going into this setting as hungry as ever. So they've got a lot going for them.
All right. The other game on Saturday is A&M and Florida, two teams that have played this season already. Florida won the series. I guess let's start with Florida, because that super regional has a fair amount to unpack. Florida swept Clemson, and that is the least interesting part of what happened on the weekend. They win, they win game one, and then on Sunday they're playing for their spot in Omaha, and Clemson and Florida played probably the game of the year. You know, I made an early declaration on game of the year last year in regionals between Clemson and Tennessee, and that got proven wrong in Omaha. So I'm going to hold off. This might have been the game of the year. We'll see if something can upstage it in the final push here in the College World Series. But that game had everything. Game two in Clemson, it had ejections, it had a skirmish, it had like a walk-off, it had an insane game-saving catch. Like, it had it all. Ultimately, though, Florida pushes through all of that. You know, the dust-up between Jack Caglione and Nick Naraki in the first couple innings of the game. You know, they push through Clemson, you know, having, you know, fighting back the way Clemson does. They push through Cam Cannarella, you know, saving Clemson's season with a ridiculous over the shoulder basket catch. And I hesitate to even say basket because he didn't catch it clean. Like, he used every part of his body to get that thing. And, you know, they push through all of that, and ultimately Florida wins in 13 innings. And I think that says a lot about what Florida is about right now, the way that they have been able to fight through Stillwater and Clemson now to get to this point. But, you know, what an insane weekend, and what a ridiculous game on Sunday in Clemson.
It was incredible. And it, like you, it's definitely my game of the year to this point. It literally had everything, and you did a great job of summing it up. Like, it was one of those games where even just watching on my couch, like, I just felt gassed at the end of it. So I can only imagine what it was like actually playing in it. Cam Cannarella, man, what a special talent. I'm so excited that we get to watch him for another year, because I think with him, the best is still yet to come. And he arguably twice saved their season or kept it going for a little while longer. He hit the game tying 3-run home run in the top of the ninth, and the catch, man, like, it might just be referred to now as the catch, because it was just so unbelievable. But with Florida, we mentioned even going way back, it feels like way back, when the tournament field was still unannounced, and it was like, hey, you know, Florida can do this. If they can go down to Georgia and win this series, if they can get over 500 and get into this tournament, like, they're going to be one of, if not the last team you want to see in your regional. And they've gone out and lived up to that, and probably even exceeded it. I thought Florida would make some noise. I didn't foresee another run to the College World Series. And they've just, from the jump in the tournament, like, it just looked like as a group, they took a huge, just collective exhale. Like, all of the stress and pressing that they had been doing all season with, like, these tough midweek losses they were taking, not being able to quite get it going on weekends, really just lack of consistency. Like, they flushed everything and have been playing up to the talent level we've known they've had all season. They just haven't been able to show it yet, and they're finally showing it. And, man, like, they are just as dangerous as can be. Like, Jack is Jack, and they have pieces around him. Like, Ashton Wilson, the true freshman, has really, really stepped up after the loss of Ty Evans. Like, he is now a legit bat in that lineup. Colby Shelton had a great weekend. Michael Robertson had a great weekend. Cade Curlin's a solid player. Like, there are pieces in there. And then you flip it over to the pitching staff. Like, Fisher Jameson has stepped up immensely. Jack Caglione, when he's on, he can go out and give you 5 to 6 dominant innings. And Brandon Neely, man, like, I can't say enough about him. Between what he did in Stillwater and what he did last weekend against Clemson, like, he is just he is a stone cold killer out of the bullpen. And you want to talk about a team that's feeling it. Like, they are really, really feeling it. Confidence is at a season high with this group. They've all been here before virtually on this stage. They know what it takes to make a run here. Like, and they get kind of a banged up Texas A&M team, and I think two very winnable matchups with Kentucky and NC State potentially awaiting them. Like, I don't think Florida's done yet.
I have Florida winning this thing, and I did not think that was going to be the case really at any point in the season. But I just, like, right now, the way that they're playing, they have the best player in the field in Jack Caglione. They have the experience factor. Like, they, you know, the vast, vast majority of this team was here last year. And, you know, what they showed me at Clemson and in Stillwater too, but, and to an extent at Georgia a couple weekends ago, like, they're ready to fight through anything right now. And this is another team that got better over the course of the season, what we saw when they were struggling really bad. You know, when think back to when they got swept at Missouri, like this is not that team. And, you know, credit to Kevin O'Sullivan for, you know, dragging them through that period and getting them to a point where right now they can go out and they can beat anyone. And they've always been able to beat anyone, but now they're doing it consistently. Like, that's the other thing. They have a series win against A&M. They have a series win against Mississippi State and Georgia and LSU, all really good teams. And they, you know, yes, they lost their series to Tennessee and Kentucky. And yes, both of those were in Gainesville, but they played them really tight. And again, like, I just feel like they're playing better today than they were back then. And, you know, so I'd be very curious to see the matchup in against either of those SEC East teams again. But especially right now, just the way that they're playing, this is a monster. And, you know, we've seen it time and again. It's about like who's hot this time of year. It's not like every year whoever's hot goes out and wins the national title. But, you know, you think back to like Ole Miss, what they were able to do, Oklahoma just getting to the College World Series finals that same year, having to go on the road twice and win a regional and a super regional on the road, and then carrying that over into Omaha. Like, it's a thing that can happen. And right now I feel like Florida is that team. So in an open field, I'm willing to take the team with the best player that's playing incredibly well right now. I don't want to say they're the hottest team, because a lot of these teams are really hot, but they are certainly right there with everyone else.
And rightfully so. And again, not to transition right into A&M.
Yeah, before you get to that, let's talk about the Clemson aspect of this all. So I don't want to like dive into like the umpiring too terribly much here, but I do want to ask you, Peter, like, we saw the dust up between Naraki and Caglione, like baseball play, whatever, like we can all, you know, say, well, maybe they shouldn't have both re-engaged, but they kind of both did re-engage. So I don't really know that anything more needed to be done there. And the ejection that came out of that play with Jack Crichton, like going back towards the dugout and finding himself back in the mix, you know, whatever. Like, I don't really want to relitigate the did players leave their position debate. Like, I will just say that rule needs to be looked at. I'm more interested in what happened in the 13th inning. So Alden Mathis hits a home run that is a go-ahead home run for Clemson. He spikes his bat rather aggressively, but it was just a bat spike in front of his own dugout. Clemson is in the first base dugout. He hits the home run. He's going up the first baseline. He's excited. He spikes his bat with his, he is facing the Clemson dugout. Like, that is allowed. Like, you can bat flip, but you have to do it like towards your dugout. You can't do it like towards, you can't throw your bat towards the other dugout, basically. And the umpires gather to, after he rounds the bases, they gather to discuss like, okay, do we need to do anything about this? And that sets off a whole chain reaction that leads to Jack Leggett and Eric Backich getting ejected and then suspended for two games that they will now serve next season. Did they, like, where are we at with bat spikes? You know, like, what, I don't want to just, like, in that tense of a game with that emotion, like, I just want to be like, whatever, man. But like, is there another side to this, or are you also on the like, he spiked his bat, what is the big deal?
I might go on another like free bases-esque rant here, because it's like, what are we doing? Like, it is the top of the 13th inning in what has been an incredibly, incredibly intense, hard-fought game, super regional, like your season's on the line, a trip to Omaha's on the line, and he hits this home biggest swing of this guy, of Alden Mathis's life, and probably will be. And like you said, the key thing here is like, everything was directed towards the Clemson dugout. I don't think he even looked at the Florida dugout. Like, he did the bat spike on the first base side. He screamed at the Clemson dugout. None of the Florida guys took exception to it. And I'm not saying like that's the end all be all of, is like, if the opponent reacts fine, then it's fine. But like, if he did something that was really no feel or out of line, like, the Florida guys would have let him know about it. No one said anything, because in that moment, any college baseball player on earth would have done the exact same thing. Like, I am all for that. I am all for the emotion. Now, as for what happened after, like, and I think it was brought up to you on Twitter, like, I think a valid question is, like, what were coaches Bakic and Leggett so upset about? And the conclusion that I've come to, unless that they came out and said something, is
so Bakic did speak to the media today, so I can clear something up. But say what we got a little bit of an explanation now, but
gotcha. What do you got? My conclusion was it was just a lot of pent up stuff over the course of a really long and game in which I think the umpiring was pretty bad on both sides. The ejection on Creighton, I think, was completely unnecessary. And I think the fact that they just had to gather in general and even assess a warning to it, like, I don't think Coach Bakic or Coach Leggett was really that out of line. And I don't know what was said, but I think them getting tossed and the suspension after was really, really harsh, just given the nature of the game. And I know that there are Pac-12 umpires, and Billy struggled at times throughout the course of the year. But I the phrasing of this sometimes gets overused, but I felt it was an unfortunate ump show at times on Sunday.
Yeah. So it seems to me, from what I'm able to piece together, we've now received we've got a statement from the umpires. And we've gotten Eric Bakic now speaking to the media. That took multiple days. Because he was ejected, he was not allowed to speak on Sunday. So Wednesday morning, we're recording this after that, he spoke, like, he gave his end of season press conference. And what he said at that and what the umpire statement say happened in the thing, like, those two things align relatively well. What we don't know, though, still is, like, why the umpires really felt the need to come together to debate the bat spike. And then both Bakic and Leggett seem to have been trying to tell the umpires, and, like, we can all sit here and debate whether this is their role or they should have not left the dugout to do this, and the rules say that they shouldn't have, but whatever. They were trying to say, like, what are we doing? Like, he spiked it toward the dugout. You're allowed to do that. And so, like, Jack Leggett, because he's not a uniform coach, like, isn't really allowed to come out of the dugout ever. And so I guess that was kind of an auto ejection on Leggett. And Bakic was not happy with that. While all of this is happening, I guess I didn't see this on the TV broadcast, but I guess, like, Bakic is, like, firing the crowd up. And the umpires were not happy with that, and so they decided to eject him for inciting the crowd. Now, I am not an umpiring expert, and this is why I don't love to, like, go into the umpiring, like, nitty-grittiness of this all, because they didn't, like, make a motion to eject him at that point. They just decided while they were talking, like, oh, he's doing that, I guess he has to be ejected for that. But they didn't do anything about it. So then they finish their meeting, which is, again, about the bat spike. They bring him out to explain what has, like, that I guess Alden Mathis received a warning at that point. But they were not ejecting Alden Mathis. So they bring Bakic out to explain this, to tell him that Leggett got ejected. And then at the end of that, they're also like, oh, and you're ejected. Like, is apparently how that goes down. And, like, that is from both parties, it seems to be, like, at the end of this, and they're like, and yes, you're now ejected. And it just seems wild to me that you can be ejected from the game and, like, they don't there was no signal given. So I think, like, if you watch that, and I have always been, like, from the moment this happened, I've been confused about, like, or curious about what happens, because you watch it, Bakic comes out to them and he's calm at that point. And, like, there seems like a normal chit chat. And then all of a sudden he goes crazy. And that probably is the point at which he was told he was ejected. I have not confirmed that yet. But, like, it's just, and then he, like, chases the umpires around the field and gets himself suspended for two games. And that was maybe not the best thing. But, like, in the moment, you know, who am I to criticize him for that? Like, a lot of people probably would have done that, maybe including me. And today, on Wednesday, he basically said he had no regrets about doing it. So if that's where he's at, that's fine. I do think that, though, the overall tensions of the game, you know, contributed to this. And if, like, the previous thing hadn't happened, nobody at Clemson probably would have been as upset about them coming together to meet. And also, if it had been the 13th inning of an elimination game, they wouldn't have been that upset. Like, if Alden Mathis had been ejected, he wouldn't have been able to play the next day. And Bakic being ejected and then getting hit with the suspension, his ejection did not come with an auto suspension. It's because he chased the umpires around the infield that he was suspended. He wouldn't have been able to coach the next day. And should Clemson have advanced to the College World Series, he wouldn't have been able to coach their opener. And like, the rules are there. I actually don't mind the if you continue to argue after an ejection, that triggers a suspension rule. It's a means for umpires to get angry coaches off of the field. But you just think about like how weird and bad that would have looked if like Alden Mathis, for spiking a bat, like let's say Clemson doesn't then blow the game. Alden Mathis, like if he had been ejected for that and they go on to win, like the next day he's out. Like what? Like this sport has some growing up to do still. And it's great that everybody wants to grow the game. And it's great that so many people are tuning into this tournament. Like that game, that Clemson Florida game was, I believe ESPN just released today, that it was the most watched super regional game ever. Amazing that people are watching the sport at that level, but this is what they're seeing when they're watching it. And it's just like, yes, we can say that players and coaches maybe need to behave better in certain situations, but things have to be improved from a rules standpoint and from a rules communication standpoint, because I do think that if the umpires had been able to say like, hey, this is why we're talking about this, like preemptively, like stop Bakic and Leggett from getting mad, that whole 13th inning unfolds like that drama unfolds differently. And we don't end up with somebody getting suspended for two games, arguing about something that ultimately wasn't even like they were concerned about something being decided that wasn't even the ultimate decision, but because they had lost total faith that, you know, things would happen in a reasonable manner, I guess that's where it ended up. And to me, like that is a real problem. And that's not to like excuse anyone's behavior, but if that's where we're at, the trust is at that low in a moment like that, then something has gone wrong, very wrong previously. And like the trust has to be rebuilt. And we have to also, like, I think, acknowledge that the game has changed a little bit. Like if you go, like, it's not to say that like college kids need to be able to do exactly what the big leaguers do, but baseball has changed and the game and the rules need to catch up to some of those changes. Like you have to meet people where they are at some point and stop trying to, you know, make them play as robotically as it seems that sometimes they are being asked to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's all perfectly said. There's got to be a better way to go about it, and especially in that type of game as well. And I think as a whole there's a real umpiring problem, which is a whole different podcast episode or two, honestly. But in a game like that, like you have to let a lot of stuff go, even going back to the Naraki Caglione little dust up. Like it was a dust up in the moment. Naraki gave him a little bit of a shove, Caglione said something to him. And I mean, that was like, there was a circle back moment in there, but nothing insane happened. And there was just typical jawing back and forth. Like it's such a big game, like, and it's an old adage, but let the kids play a little bit. Like these are all big time competitors and really, really good players. Like let them freaking play. And no, like I didn't see anything wrong that anyone did over the course of this entire game, whether it was Nolan Naraki, Jack Caglione, Jack Crichton, Alden Mathis, anyone. Like I just thought that was really fun and intense baseball. There has to be a better way to do it. There just has to be. But that's my two cents on it.
All right, let's go to A&M. We still have one more of these. And A&M took care of Oregon and they win, they sweep. The stuff on the field, like it mattered. They had a kind of crazy comeback in game two. But it all felt like it was just over. First of all, like, I don't know how many people gave Oregon any chance going in. So good on the Ducks for playing this one as tough as they did. But it all just felt overshadowed by Braden Montgomery getting injured in game one on a very awkward play at the plate. He his feet caught and, he suffered what I guess is some sort of lower leg injury. I've seen it reported as a broken ankle. He is out for the season. And then game two starter, Shane Sadeo, left in after throwing just 11 pitches with the medical staff. He leaves the game. Coach Schlossnagel post game said that he had passed some of the initial tests, but they needed to do an MRI before they were going to know what was really going on. As of time of recording, I have not heard anything more about the MRI. I don't even know if it's been done yet, but presumably he is. We are not going to see him this season, and we'll hope that we can see him next season, because if the worst happened, you also won't be seeing him next weekend or next season. So very unfortunate that A&M suffered those two injuries. Those are two really crucial ones. You know, you never want to see anybody get hurt at any time of the year, but especially players like that on the, you know, getting injured during super regionals and then not being available during the College World Series is like, that's as brutal as it gets.
Yeah. It's hard to say if any team in the College World Series is like not hot coming into it, because they will have won a regional and then a super regional.
Yeah, A&M's won 5 straight games, so like, yeah, they haven't lost in the postseason yet.
Exactly, and they're like on paper, like that's as, I mean, they're perfect right now. But it, like you said, it is severely overshadowed, I think, by two really, really significant injuries. Like they are literally kind of limping into Omaha. It is still a really good team, but like, full disclosure, if they were coming into this thing fully healthy, I probably would have picked them to win the national title. That's how good they are. And the lineup I still really, really like. You know, there's the star power there with Jace Lavallette and Gavin Grahovic, and they've had a couple of older guys really step up, and Caden Kent, especially, credit to him. He was slotted in Braden Montgomery's slot, and he hit that key grand slam in game two of the Super Regional. And then on the mound, they are very fortunate to have the bevy of weapons that they do, whether it's Ryan Prager in the rotation, or the bevy of, or the number of bullpen weapons that they have with guys like Evan Aschenbeck, Zane Budmaev, Chris Cortez has been excellent in the postseason. Like, I think that they have their work cut out for him. But you know, it's still a really dangerous and a really, really good A&M team. And them against Florida, like, I don't know. I kind of favor Florida in that one, just given the trajectory, I guess, of the two teams. But we'll see how much wind has actually been taken out of A&M's sails here pretty soon, really in 48 or so hours. But I would have been a lot more bullish on the Aggies if they were coming into this thing at full strength.
I'm more concerned about them on the mound, which feels weird to say, because I feel like that's been more of the strength over the course of the season. But all of a sudden, it just feels like they only have one starter now. And, you know, like they, you know, had moved Sadeo into the rotation late in the season and then moved him up to that number two spot. And like, I just applauded Virginia for doing the same thing, but you know, so maybe this is a little hypocritical from me, but it just doesn't feel as, like, to then lose that guy, like, that doesn't feel I don't really know where they're going to turn after Ryan Prager. And the bullpen is great. Aschenbeck and Cortez can cover a lot of innings, but you know, they have
starters.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't loved Tanner Jones all year, and now it seems like Tanner Jones is going to have to pitch a really important game for them, or somebody else, you know. And meanwhile, you know, I don't want to minimize who Braden Montgomery is at all. He's a top 10 pick in a month's time, and he was their three hole hitter, and he was, you know, he was their top hitter. You can argue about him and Chase about which one's better, but like, he was really, really important to that team. But I just feel like with what they have offensively, I'm a little less concerned about that. That just, what are they going to do? Who are they going to start in a game two or in a game three if they get to it?
Yeah, and it's a great question. I guess we'll see soon. But yeah, rotationally, that is a huge, huge blow. Like, Sadeo has, I mean, he's just been excellent for really all of this season. So it's going to be interesting to see how they navigate through that.
Alrighty, so those are our picks. As you heard, I'm picking Florida. Or those are the teams and the supers. As you heard, I'm picking Florida. Peter is picking Tennessee. I have Florida beating Virginia. He has Tennessee beating NC State. So both of us taking SEC teams in this SEC-ACC challenge, but not an all-ACC finals as we saw last year and 2 years ago. So we'll have a lot of fun baseball ahead of us. There's a lot of other baseball news happening. South Carolina hired Paul Maneri as its coach. The portal is hot. Other parts of the coaching carousel are hot. And of course, draft preparations continue in earnest, both for us and for big league teams. And as we record this on Wednesday, we just revealed our draft preview cover on MLB Network. It features Charlie Condon, so you can look forward to seeing that in your inbox soon, I guess, if you are a Baseball America subscriber. So check everything out over on the website, baseballamerica.com. You can follow us. I'm on Twitter at Ted Cahill. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. And make sure you are following or subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app of choice, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find the Baseball America podcast and make sure you hit that follow button. We will come back next week with another edition, probably on Friday after the finals have been decided. It's kind of crazy that we're like a week away from just being down to two teams in the country playing for a national title. So that's probably when we'll talk to you next. But again, if you're subscribed, that'll pop right up into your phone, and you won't have to think about did we actually record on Friday as Teddy promised. So enjoy the baseball. I know we're going to. It's a great time of year. For Peter, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.